You're listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas.
Welcome back to another edition of The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas. This one brought to you by Endesa. And it means so much to me to have the ability to still bring you this podcast during these trying times. And I especially appreciate the fact that the coaches, and in this case, players, have taken time to sit down with me, even if we cannot be face-to-face, to talk about their incredible careers. Today, it's my pleasure to introduce a player that actually approached me about doing this podcast, and at the time, he had no idea he was already on my list. Please welcome to The Crossover one of the purest shooters and nicest strokes, and on top of that, he's a lefty, Mr. Kelvin Creswell Rivers. Welcome, my man. How you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
I'm doing good, man. I have to say that since the first day I've known you, it's always been KC. And when I started doing this research on you, man, it's like Kelvin Creswell Rivers. I never knew that was your full name. I kind of assumed there had to be something to the KC, but I didn't know there was that.
That's funny, because I had a friend the other day who was on the phone, and we were doing a little bit of trading together. And he was like, Kelvin, he said, we've known each other for 30 years. I've never known your name was Kelvin. He's like, oh, I've only known you as KC.
I don't feel that bad then. I was like, when I saw it, I was like, not that I didn't know that it was probably part of your name, but I looked at him like, why have I never heard that before? And the thing about it is Kelvin Creswell sounds just like anybody's name if you drop the Rivers.
Right.
Usually I start this part a little bit at the end, but with the times that we're dealing with, I got to ask you, man, you said you're in Riverside, California, right?
Yep.
You took off from Zalgiris or from Kaunas and went back, like, right, obviously when we got the news that the EuroLeague was going to be suspended for a little while, you flew straight back. Was your family with you at that time, or did they fly back with you to California?
Yeah, they were with me. We actually stayed, once they canceled everything, we stayed around another week or so in Kaunas just to kind of play everything by ear and see what was happening. We kind of felt safer in Kaunas because it wasn't right. Really anything going on there. Maybe a couple mild cases, but once the State Department of the U.S. declared foreign workers and U.S. citizens that was abroad to come back home, we had to leave, and it was an abrupt trip. We got a late flight to where we left Kaunas and had to fly to London and stay in London overnight, and then we had a direct flight to L.A. So it wasn't too bad. It was just an overnight stay, and our kids get right. Restless all the time, so they're good travelers, but having to stay overnight, yeah, and explain to them it's bad.
Yeah, it's not that easy for an adult, let alone a kid.
Yeah.
So I mean, what's your day like? What's your days are like these days? I mean, what do you do? I mean, other than I gotta assume that you're still keeping in shape. But how hard is it for you guys to do it from home?
It's hard, man. I mean, I had a treadmill, I got weights, I got a bicycle that I actually love doing. But it's hard, it's not much motivation, because it's like right now I'm in off season mode. It's like I'm resting now. It's like I got the chance to just rest, and it's like I'm thinking in my head, here we go. We got EuroLeague talking about we might pick the season back up, and you gotta think, okay, I gotta get back in shape, I gotta stay in shape. It's a lot, but then it's like you want to live life. You're at home, and I'm fortunate enough to have my own pool, and the weather is hot here now. So it's a lot of things that's kind of in the way of trying to stay in shape. But, I mean, I manage to do it when I can, but I do it when I can.
As a ball player, man, there's nothing like summer mode. and to have summer mode in the middle of the season or towards the end of the season is just got to be so difficult. Now, you say you got a girl who's 6 and a boy who's 3.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they obviously maybe were going to some school, whatever, they had to come back and go home. We were talking before we went on air here, that they just don't get it. Kids don't get it that much, about staying in home and being, just watching out where you touch and everything else. How's that go, man, with the kids? It's got to be driving everybody crazy.
Man, it does. And, my daughter is very, very smart. So everything is a question. It's a why. Why this? Why that? My son kind of goes along with the flow. He kind of goes to his own beat. But for her, she's curious now. She's in that curious stage as to why things are the way they are, why we can't go places. And you have to constantly explain. But now that, again, the weather is hot, they love the pool. So this is like the best oasis we can give them is just being outside, being able to just get in the pool and stay in there all day. And for us, it's good because, for kids, that pool water after a while, once it hits them, they're tired. So it's just
it's bath time,
dinner, and bed. So it's easy for me and my wife.
Perfect. Look, man, I played professionally for 13 years. Not as many teams as you've played on, but we'll get to that later. In the middle of something like this, you know, and I'm not going to try to start this thing out by being controversial here, but I've been thinking about so many different people, like their situations and different situations, you know. I mean, we can get into a million things during this situation. You get into a married couple that wasn't doing well, you know what I mean, before this happened. Now they're stuck together all day long. But are you sure you're ready for my question?
Ready. I'm ready.
All right, here it goes. I don't want to be controversial right up front, but I need to know. I love my kids to death. I have three of them. I had two most of the time when I was playing. And I always feel like they're my life. And the fact remains that, you know, as a ball player, there's constant outside demands on you. Practices, appearance, events, games, travel, et cetera, et cetera. So my question is, how hard is it to be home around the family, especially like during mid-season? And understand what I'm saying here, because it goes both angles. Because when y'all travel, you know, your wife and your kids have that set routine at home. And when you come home, we always break that routine.
Right.
You know what I mean? And now all of a sudden, this is just thrown upon you. How does that affect, you know, the relationship, the kids, the whole family fixture? How does that go?
Well, now, I mean, it's really understanding who they are as kids. You know, we have a small understanding as fathers, you know, athletes, because we're gone most of the time. So, you know.
Right.
The wife, she has the understanding. She knows the body languages, the attitudes, she knows everything, how to coach and calm them down. And we're still kind of playing catch up because we're gone so much. And then you only see a little bit of what's going on. So now I'm sitting here and I'm able to observe everything that she's observing, even with things, they do now. Like I was trying to do business trading the other day. I'm sitting here studying it and I'm studying, and something happens. They're fighting each other. They're doing stuff. And now I'm getting up, and I'm like, just give me a moment to just do what I need to do, and you guys just chill out. And my wife looks at me, and she goes, now you know how I feel when you're gone, and I got to deal with this on a regular basis. And I'm like,
hey, man,
I understand that.
You walked me right into my next question. I was going to be like, I can guarantee that she's told you, see what I have to go through all the time?
All the time. Even when I come back off the road, it's like, the level of cleanliness in the house changes when I come back, according to her.
I hear
like,
you,
she's
man.
Like, everything I was clean. You come back, the kids do what they want to do. And I'm sorry. You know?
That's all you can do is put your hands up and say, I'm sorry, my bad. All right, man, let's go. Let's get into this. March 1st, 1987. Remember that day, don't you?
Yeah.
Casey's born in Charlotte, North Carolina. I can't wait to get to your high school years, but let's get into your whole time. I love Charlotte. I dated a girl in Charlotte for about 4 or 5 years. When I was living in Charleston, South Carolina, I'd spend every other weekend up in Charlotte. And I love the city, but how long were you there for? Your mom and dad, what kind of influence were on you in your childhood about basketball and everything else? What was your situation in Charlotte?
Well, my biological father passed of a brain aneurysm when I was 6 years old, so I didn't really.
When you were six,
yeah, I didn't really have much of a time to, you know, actually get to know him. But
wow,
my mom definitely held it down. She was no nonsense. She wasn't on a strict leash, but because I didn't have a father figure around at a time, she literally had to pick up the pieces. My uncle, I don't know, a lot of people don't know, my uncle played in Europe for a long time, Byron Dinkin. So he was in and out, but he had that father figure role for me once upon a time.
Oh, Byron was your uncle?
Yeah, Byron's my uncle. It's my mom's brother, so.
Oh, okay, I never knew that. That's interesting.
So he's the one that put the ball in my hand, and that's basically how it took off from there. You know, basketball.
What about brothers and sisters?
Did you have brothers and sisters? I have one brother. So we're all 7 years apart. I have an older sister who is 40. My brother is 20. He's 26 now. We're all 7 years apart. I'm the middle child, but I get all the attention. So
the middle child usually doesn't get all the attention.
Exactly.
So your biological dad dies of a brain aneurysm, and your mom has to take care of three kids.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's
man. I mean, that's just that has to be so hard for her. And so your first experience with basketball then came from your uncle.
From my uncle, and I have a guy that I considered like a play uncle. His name was Malcolm Sanders. And they were good friends with my mom and my uncle. They grew up right across the street, and he was always doing youth programs and different sports at the time. He introduced me as well, putting me on a team when I was about 4 or 5. And this is the first time, you know, I've ever been in a team setting. I was taller than everybody. I didn't know nothing. I was, you know, I was just out of whack. I looked like a kid that didn't belong. I didn't look like I was going to play basketball, to be honest with you. But over time, you know, I started to love it. And because of them two, you know, I started to play basketball, and it was an outlet for me, which transpired me to play other sports. So it was beneficial.
Yeah, that was my next question, because, you know, in the States, back in the day, my day's a lot longer back than yours is, obviously, but we were able to play all the sports, football, tennis, volleyball, whatever. I mean, anything that we can get, if the time restraints were okay, we could play anything. Were you one of those? Were you the multi-sport guy?
Yeah, I actually was. We actually had a group of guys. There was probably about, I want to say, 12 of us, and we used to transition straight from basketball to baseball to football back to basketball. So literally we had our team. Yeah. We didn't need, you know, to have tryouts or do anything special. We might add a guy here and there, but we basically had our team. So it was just a straight transition. You didn't need to get to know anybody else. You knew who was on your team.
Nope.
And we did that for quite some time. I want to say till we were about, I think, 13 or 14, and I think everybody started kind of branching off once we hit high school, because more guys was into one sport than another, and that's just has been my life, traveling, playing sports.
So from Charlotte, North Carolina, now you've grown up with these kids, and you know, you talked about a big influence. Is, you know, most people here don't know about those rec places where we used to go out and play all the time. You know what I mean? Where all the kids just hung out, and man, if it wasn't for places like that, we would have gotten so much trouble back in the day. How many people influenced you back then, you know, to just keep you straight? Because I mean, I don't want anybody to take this in a negative way, but it's just reality. A child growing up with two brothers, you know, a brother and a sister, and with a single mom and a dad that's passed away, you can get in a lot of trouble, especially in Charlotte.
You could, but I mean, for me, I had, you know, family members. My grandmother, we lived with my grandmother as well. My grandmother was a school teacher. She taught second grade, and she was a disciplinarian. Mm-hmm. So I knew, you know, my grandmother didn't play. She was a sweetheart, but, you know, granny didn't play.
I said, grandmothers always have that reputation, man. I've always heard of grandmothers spoiling kids, but then they always say, like, yeah, she'll spoil you, but she'll also whack you, too.
They are. They definitely are. And that for my grandmother, I thank her a lot for that, because at times when my mom wasn't around and I used to test her just to see, yeah, oh, man, I used to get it.
Hey, take me to high school now. So you're in Charlotte, North Carolina. How do you get to Oak Hill Academy?
It's crazy. A lot of people ask that, but I had a friend of my uncle's, name was Corey Baker. He used to play at Oak Hill, and he was coaching a local high school in Charlotte, and they were playing Oak Hill. And the talent in Charlotte wasn't getting bad, but I was looking more so for a challenge.
Right.
And Corey mentioned Oak Hill. And my uncle was like, okay, well, you know, we'll check out Oak Hill. So they come in town. We get to meet Coach Smith, great guy. Mm-hmm. And he's telling me, all right, well, you know, come up to the school, look around. You know, I'll let you go up and down, because they play pickup every day. So he let me play pickup with the guys to kind of see, you know, if I was something he'd be interested in.
Right.
Lo and behold, I get up there, and I just had one session of pickup where I was just going to town. And he stopped me, pulled me to the side. We go into his office. He's like, listen, I'm going to give you a scholarship to the school here. If you want it, it's yours. And I was like, yes, definitely. So it was something I really wanted to do. And I really enjoyed it there. You know, I really got to be around a great group of guys, especially my junior year, you know, meeting Ray John Rondo and Josh Smith, two, you know, elite athletes at the time, man. It was crazy to see how these guys operated.
for the people that don't know, I grew up with DeMatha back in my day. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. of course, where you're from, you know about DeMatha also, especially going to Virginia afterwards. But, you know, for the people that don't know Oak Hill, I mean, you got alumni like Kevin Durant, Rajon Rondo, as you mentioned, Carmelo Anthony. I mean, the list just goes on and on of the amount of people. And there's only like 150 kids that can attend that school per year, right?
Yes, that's basically it. I would say it's 130 kids and about 20 staff, maybe a little more staff, but mm-hmm. it's a very, very small town. Like, it's nothing there. When I tell you it's nothing, it's nothing. Like, you can get bored. You can get bored, Ben. It's almost like it's literally a quarantine life, kind of, I should say. But it was an experience.
So it prepared you for this then?
Yeah, yeah. I'm used to this. Sitting in the house, you can play games, be on the computer, be outside. That's about it.
You know what I laugh at? When I read up a little bit more on it, it said it was a college prep school, you know, and I started to think, I'm like, guys like Melo, Durant, they didn't need any college prep. They probably went to classes for about a half a year until that first semester's done. Then they were finished.
That is it.
Yeah, but it prepped guys like you. You went 72-2 in two seasons, won the USA Today National Championship.
Yeah, we won it twice. We won it twice in a row, 2 years straight. Second year was kind of shaky, but that first year we dominated.
You were part of that 65 game win streak they had.
Right.
Now tell me, my question is, you know, I try not to go too negative, because I like to stay with the positive, but who were the two losses you had, dude, and who were on those teams?
Our first loss we lost to was South Gwinnett High School. They had a guy you should know of the name Lewis Williams, Lou Will. Lou Will was just like unbelievable, but he wasn't the star of the team that day. They had another guy named Mike Mercer who was just phenomenal, that just demolished us. He killed us, and that was our first loss. And our second loss came, I'm trying to think who else we lost to. That one's a tough one because I remember it, but now I'm forgetting it. It was a dumb loss.
Oh, there's only two losses, man.
Yeah, I got it now. We lost to a team. We was in a tournament in Kentucky, the Marshall County Hoop Fest. It was a big tournament at the time. We ended up losing at the buzzer to a team out of Chicago, and that was the only two losses. And that year there, I was hurt. I broke my ankle, so I was out for majority of the season that year. But I think had I played, we might only have one loss.
There you go. I looked at a list of all the players that went through Oak Hill, and I mean, we all, if you're from the States, you know exactly the history of this school. I didn't see that many people that end up having European careers after. Is it because you go to that school with the idea that you're going big time?
Majority of the time, most of the guys that come are 4-star, 5-star guys with the potential to go to the NBA. You know, not too many have that mindset of, you know, I can go to Europe. We have some European guys. It's a guy that played in Cholet in the Lithuanian League, Rokas Gustys, who actually went to Oak Hill. I didn't even know that, you know, till I seen his name.
I saw his name on the list.
Yeah, I seen his name.
But he's already Lithuanian. That doesn't really count,
right,
does it?
Right, right. But I mean, at the same time, you know, most of the guys that come from overseas, you know, they come with the aspirations of, this is the channel that I can use to go on to college or to the NBA.
So from there, you get, how many other people recruited you other than Clemson? I mean, Clemson's a great school, AC&C. I have to admit, when I moved to Charleston, I was in Charleston for about 10 years, most of my friends were Gamecock fans. So
it's you know, that's Gamecock Central down there, I want to say. We don't get
too much.
Yeah,
I know, I know. So Clemson wasn't a great school as far as basketball was concerned. Most of it already know it as football, but tell me about those 4 years. I mean, were you thinking that, you know, from there you can go pro and play in the NBA?
I had an opportunity, but before then, I mean, I was recruited by, I had Wake Forest, I had UConn, I had a couple of schools. Mm-hmm. But once I got hurt and the way my injury looked, most of those schools dropped off because it was deemed that I would never play basketball again. That's how bad the injury was.
What injury was that? I didn't see that anywhere.
We had a practice one night. Actually, it was crazy because the two nights before, I had a whole bunch of coaches in the stands. We had a whole bunch of coaches, Clemson, everybody. And literally, I put on a performance that my coach was like, Clemson might, you know, one of these schools is definitely going to be the place you're going to go. And Clemson was going to be in the mm-hmm. foreshadow. I was actually, I think I had actually committed to Clemson already. But at this point, I had the thought process of decommitting because I had a great summer. And right. I came back, you know, to really have a excellent year. And I was thinking, like, man, I'm about to go somewhere else. Like, Clemson, I like you, but listen, the way I'm feeling, I could get, you know, a bigger school. But we've had a scrimmage Friday night, just pick up our normal routine. I go up to dunk. And at the time, I was athletic. People might not believe it, but I was I was fearless and athletic, and I got undercutted.
I was just going to ask you, dunk,
yeah,
really?
Really, really. And, you know, it's something that weighs on me for times now. It still bothers me. But I got undercutted in the air, and I landed on my ankle, my right ankle, and the foot and everything, the toes were, like, behind my kneecap and whatnot. The foot twisted that bad. Ooh. So I dislocated it and tore, like, basically all the ligaments, and the fibula was a clean break. So I was done. And once everybody heard that, it was like I stopped getting letters and everything except for Clemson. He actually came to the hospital. The head coach came to the hospital after my surgery. Yeah, Oliver came in and he told me face to face, he's like, even if you can't play another day of basketball in your life, you deserve to have a 4-year scholarship. And I felt loyal to that. And it was like, you know, that was my only other option, or that, or, you know, probably go JUCO or prep school, another prep school. But definitely I felt loyal to that and I stuck with it.
That's huge, man, that a college coach would come up and offer you a scholarship with a limited amount of D1 scholarships and tell you that no matter what, you're going to be part of this school. You just gave me the chills, man. That's pretty good. That's pretty cool.
You know, I respected him. I felt loyal to him because it was just like, here it is.
Right.
I could have easily been sitting at home, no scholarship, with a story like I was this way. And then this injury happened and now I'm just another guy. But he gave me that opportunity, and I was real gracious for it.
That injury was like the Paul George injury
Injury. And actually, his was a little better than mine because his was more so he kind of landed into the apparatus, into the backstop. But mine was I was in the air, and I'm landing. So that forceful impact just made it worse.
The next question I have is – I mean, you kind of answered it in a nutshell, but I'm going to go your side of it instead of the coach's side. How important is it? You had Oliver Purnell for all 4 years of your career at Clemson. How important is that for a player to mature and to become the best that he can be in a 4-year school? Because you see so many players being recruited by somebody, a new coach coming in. All of a sudden, a new coach comes in with his recruits, his coaching staff. They don't like you for whatever reason. You don't get the time because you jumped in and you were playing 25 minutes a game from your freshman year, even after that injury.
It's important. I mean, I think the fact that he stayed there 4 years was great in itself because it gave me an opportunity to really get to understand him and really find out what his plans were for me as the one of the top players he recruited at the time. Because, you know, you get coaches, they tell you a million things to get you there. And then when you get there, the plans kind of alter. Right. But, you know, his plans never really altered. He had this vision for what he wanted to happen, and for the most part, it happened right when it happened for me. And I feel like I had one regret that I should have took advantage of was my sophomore year. I went from averaging, you know, I think I was averaging like 7 my freshman year to like 14 or 15 my sophomore year. And we got knocked out of a chance, a bid for the tournament, but we went to the NIT tournament and we ended up going all the way to the NIT championship, ended up losing to West Virginia. But
I remember that
tournament, I think I was averaging relatively around 20 or so for the whole tournament. And I kept hearing him ask me before we even went to New York to play in the tournament. He kept asking me about NBA. Was I considering the NBA? What did I think about the NBA? And me being a kid, not knowing the avenues that you could use to understand your position in the NBA that they have, where you can kind of write in and find out your stock and where you're viewed at. I didn't know none of that. I just knew he was asking for general purposes. So I just took it as, you know, he just asking, am I curious about it? Is it a goal, is it an aspiration? That's how I looked at it. But come to find out from some insiders that I've met through my time when I spent in the G League, they were like, man, you know, you were top 20, 25 at this time because the NIT really pushed you and you were a sophomore. Really? You know, and that's kind of what the NBA goes for, that youth, that freshness, that young guy to come through. And I said, I didn't know that. I mean, I knew he was asking, but I didn't know he was asking for a reason. And so that was like one thing after you find out, you're like, man, now I sit back and I'm like, damn, that's why he was asking me this. Like, this is why he kept posing this question as to what I thought about it. Was I thinking about it? And, you know, we make mistakes and we, I ain't gonna say mistakes, but we make decisions. And I look at it like, you're supposed to be where you are for a reason. I was supposed to be a certain place for a reason. You know, everything's not meant for everybody. And that's just kind of how I look at it now.
You took that school to, I mean, they were in six NCAA tournaments in over 28 years, from 1980 to 2008. And then from 2008 to 2011, they went 4 years in a row. I mean, you guys built that pretty much, that legacy with Coach Purnell. I mean, that was a squad that was never supposed to go that far as you guys went, not even to an NIT finals.
It spoke volumes to just the group we had. We had a young group when I came in my freshman year. It was a young group that relatively, we only had two seniors that year. So everybody else were sophomores and juniors. So that next year we were already together and we had that determination, okay, we're going to break through and really show that we can play some ball down here in Clemson. Because, you know, the ACC is, that's Tobacco Road country.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, with a mix of Maryland and Virginia, you know, but that's Tobacco Road country.
Yeah.
And we wanted to be in that mix.
Yeah, Clemson has always been that outsider of that ACC. But tell me what my favorite question to anybody who's been through school for 4 years, what that last game feel like, man? That last game in your Clemson uniform.
It's different, man, because you know it's over. You know that college life is over. You know, and that last horn ring, it was like reality kicked in that it wasn't no next year or, you know, I'm gonna come back even stronger. It was like, this was it. And I never forget it because I took the last shot of my last game. We were down two against Michigan in the first round of the tournament. And I got a wide open – well, not even a wide open. It was a double team shot. But I literally was going to make sure I was going to take that shot. Like, I didn't want anybody else to take that shot. Mm-hmm. And it broke me because I missed. And I went to the locker room and the only thing that ran through my mind was like, it's done. It's over with. Now it's on to professional. It's on to figuring out about agencies and what to do next.
But at that point, like you said, you might have missed the opportunity 2 years before that. And now all of a sudden this comes up and you don't get drafted in the NBA. I mean, your options, you know, obviously you're thinking Europe, you're thinking whatever, but you know, you start to question, you know, what is next? And that question is never answered in your own mind because you don't have the answers. That's what makes that question so hard.
It's the unknown.
at this point, what did you know about Europe? Your uncle played over there, so you had some.
That's the only thing I really knew about Europe. You know, when he would come home, he would bring home tapes, and he played most of his career in Greece. So when the years that he was there, like I would watch tapes when he was with, Peristeri, you know, him and Al Ford played together, you know.
Oh, really? He played with Alfonso, okay.
Yeah. I would watch them two play and play and play. And then as I was coming along, it's crazy because he brought home a tape of Diamantidis. And because, you know, Diamantidis was left-handed and he's a smooth lefty and I was left-handed, my uncle was like, look, I want you to watch this guy. I want you to watch how he plays. He's like, he's gonna be a star. Watch him. So I used to watch a couple times different tapes of Diamantidis and how he played. And you know, it's different, the European style from the American style, because it's like I can incorporate that in my game, but we play this way here, and you know,
it didn't look good.
No, it looked different, and it was something it looked different. That, looking back on it now, as an adult at my age, I wish that I would have looked at it in a light of I can use this to be different on the court, you know. And then I run into playing the Diamantidis, and it's like, wow, like I've been watching this guy, you know, as a youngster, and here I am playing against him. So it's different.
I'm gonna give you a little hint here. You're only 33, and I'm, you know, I got you by about 21 years, I guess it is. You're making yourself sound old when you start saying tapes, man.
Man, listen, listen. As tapes come around, I found a tape. My wife has some tape of her and her sisters when they were kids. And she looks at me, she's like, do we have something to put this on? And I'm looking at her like,
exactly.
Do we have something to put this on? Like, we got to go to a pawn shop or something and get a VCR to really play this thing. Like, I don't know what we're going to do with this.
That's hilarious, man. So how do you get to Italy then? Because you don't sound like you were one of these players. Like, you sound like me when I was going through college. I had no idea about the process, about the agents. You know, no one was helping me with that. It almost sounds like that's you.
It kind of was, but as the college school year was ending, I met up with Wasserman Media Group. At the time was ran by Arne Tellem. And Maktar Jai was doing a lot of the guys throughout the ACC. He was the one kind of branching out and, you know, expanding the agency through the ACC wavelength. So he came to visit me and a guy named Dan Tobin and kind of pitched their way about how Wasserman ran things, the number of first round picks they had, you know, the whole hoopla about things that right. In my head, kind of, I'm like, you don't consider me in that top group, because usually those guys, they already have their agents picked by the time the season is almost finished. So, I mean, I signed with them, did a lot of workouts. I did 13 NBA workouts. A few times I went back twice to a couple of cities. So I was kind of hopeful in that aspect that I was being brought back a couple of times to different cities. But I ended up signing in a small city in Latina that I was shocked to go to. I never heard of them, didn't know nothing about them. They had just came to second division Italy, and it was just like, oh my goodness, what am I getting myself into? And that's literally how I felt. The whole plane ride to the time the people picked me up to get into the city, it was just like a shock. I didn't know what to expect.
I love the fact that you're answering my questions, because for some reason or another, you and I have seemed like we have such a similar path, other than you went to much bigger schools than I did in high school and college, but I was the same thing. I flew into Rome. Yeah, I got lucky. Got in the NBA somehow. I never know how I got there, but I got there for a short period of time. But I flew into Rome, and they tried to put me right back on the flight to go home because my agent, I guess, told him I was a 7-footer.
Oh, wow.
Because the guy, their big man got hurt, like blew his ankle out or something, and they needed another big man, so they called me, and I'm. Hell, and they're trying to get me back on the plane in Rome. So it's like, I was the same thing. It was a shock from the minute I got off the plane until they brought me to this little town in Caserta. And you know, and I was playing with Oscar Schmidt. Mm-hmm. My first game with him, he shot 29 threes in one game. Dude, you'd love that. So it's a complete shock for us to come over. But that didn't seem to affect you. You only played in 10 games, averaged like 24 a game, and all of a sudden Benetton suits you up. What's the deal with that?
Literally, my first four games in the second division, I was averaging like 33, 34. And I was playing like a madman because I didn't want to be there. I wasn't going to lie. I didn't want to be there. I just because it was new to me. I didn't know nothing about it. So the way I figured I was going to get out of there was, I was like, I just got to play completely crazy to get out of here. And it was working to some degree. Like, I was thinking like, okay, I'm going to go home. Somebody going to see me. Eventually, it's going to show that I can play at that level. But the more and more I started to play and the more and more I started to actually interact with the Italian guys and my coach, the more I started to gain a small appreciation for Europe. Because my coach, the first game I was out there, I'm trying to pass. Because European, all I knew is it's a team game. That's all I kept hearing before I went over. It's a team game. So first game, I'm out there trying to pass and score smallly, I should say. Like, I was just passing everybody, and we were down like 25-8 the first game. And my coach calls a timeout, and he comes and looks at me. He's like, hey, I didn't sign you to pass the ball. He's like, I don't care who's on you. He's like, score. So that first game, I finished with 33-34 because literally every time I touched it, I was just shooting it. So I was like, okay, if this is going to work, I'm just going to keep doing this. So it just started the snowball effect. Then after a while, like the fifth game we played, I remember getting double team and triple team, and a triangle and two was placed on me. So that was kind of weird. Yeah. But Benetton had lost a guy named Cartier Martin, who I think had played in the NBA at one point.
Yeah, I remember.
They were looking for another wing guy. And they said it was between me and I don't know if you remember Desmond Mason at the time.
Yeah.
He used to play with the Sonics, yeah.
Yeah, he was with the Sonics for years.
I had a feeling. I was like, he's not coming to Europe. I was like, he's been in the NBA. I was like, he's had success in the NBA. He's not coming to Europe. So I figured I would have a chance at going to Benetton. And sure enough, my agent calls one night. He's like, listen, pack your bags. You and your girlfriend get ready because y'all going to move to Treviso. You know, they're going to buy you out. So I'm shocked because I'm moving up to the first division. I heard about Benetton, and it was like, oh my goodness, like this used to be considered the 30th NBA team, the 31st NBA team.
Right.
Like I know for sure.
Kukoc, Vinny Del Negro, all those guys.
So I get there and it's different. It's the organization is run different because it was ran like a NBA team.
Right.
That in itself was like a start for me.
To me, it's an interesting story because I don't know when you knew you were coming over here, you were going to a second division team, not a first division team. And you definitely didn't know the fact that, you know, back in the day, you could sit in the second division for years. No matter how well you play, people just look at you like you're a second division player. But you were able to shake that off in like 10 games. And then you started playing in the Euro Cup also with Benetton. So you were just thrown right into the fire at that point.
I jump right into it. But you know what's crazy? You speaking of second division player, one of the best bigs right now of our time being in Europe starting, I don't know if he started in the second division, but he played in the second division, Cal Hines. Because one of my first games was against Cal Hines. He was playing in Imola, him and Dante Draper were teammates. So, you know, it speaks volumes just, you know, how you can start somewhere and end up in great places. And, you know, look at his career. It's a hell of a career.
Yeah, but you can't include Kyle Hines in that because he's a 6'3", 5 man. He could do anything he wants, man.
Yeah, you're right about that, man.
It's unbelievable, man. I mean, what he's done with his career, with his, I mean, he's got incredible ability, but the fact that he could only play the 5 spot at that size is just amazing, man.
Great.
Hey, I'm going over my numbers, man, and I'm looking at you and I'm going 14 different teams in 11 years. That doesn't really include, like, you had a double stint with Real Madrid. So it's actually 15 different teams in those 11 years. I've been fortunate enough to do this podcast for a couple of years now, and I've been fortunate enough to talk to so many good coaches and so many great players. And one thing that I've noticed is amazing to me is I've dealt with 3 great players, all right? all three of them were great scorers, all right? The crazy part about it, all three of y'all are lefties. All three of you has actually passed through Panathinaikos. You know who the other two are? You know them? You know the names yet?
I'm sitting here. I'm thinking.
Let me give them to you. I got Keith Langford, who's played in 16 teams in 14 different seasons.
That's right.
I got you, who's played with 15 different teams over, 10 seasons, and I got Tyrese Rice, has played in 9 different teams in 10 seasons. What's the deal in Europe with these left-handed scorers? Why are they flying all over the place? Why can't y'all stick with one team for a long period of time?
I don't know. And if you ask somebody, they will probably try to question, you know, character, and that's not that. It's not that at all. I just think.
Well, that's always the first thing that people think of when you're going from team to team. And I've met all three of you guys, And you know, I think Keith would probably be the closest one that you could like sit down and talk to him. Like, yeah, I could see like someone not wanting to keep Keith around for too long. Cause I love sitting down because he's like old school, you know, he'll tell you exactly the way it is. And he's not going to pull any punches, but you and Tyrese it's like, you know, and I'm not saying nothing bad about Keith cause Keith was a ball player, but I could see where you get that reputation, and neither one of y'all deserve that.
It's hard because you get prepared to try to stay somewhere for such a long time and everything changes. Like, I was hoping somewhere along the line I would have still been in Madrid, you know, and that's just honest God truth. I loved it there. I loved the organization.
Right.
You know, I loved, you know, playing with the guys on the team. It was fun. Like, we all had a bond. You know, I thought I would be a part of that for quite some time, and, you know, things take their course and they alter, and, you know, it altered for the best for them. You know, end up winning another EuroLeague title and, you know, getting close to winning a third one. But you know, I felt like I was still a part of that. You know, I wanted to still be a part of that. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know what happened. You know, everybody tells me, oh, it's just, you know, they wanted something different. And it's like, but what happened? What made them want something different? Because I left and I came back. So I used to always question, like, you know, it's just weird. You brought me back for a reason. Why, you know?
And it's a weird situation because we're going to jump ahead a little bit because, I mean, you balled in Madrid, too. It wasn't like, I mean, you know, the Final Four game against Fenerbahce, and you dropped 17 in that game, 5 for 6 from the three-point line. I mean, you know, obviously that's one of my questions about you coming back, but I want to touch first the D-League. What made you – you were kind of rolling around in Europe, and you were kind of working up that ladder between Italy and France, and you went to Russia, and you got in a couple of big Russian teams, Khimki, Lokomotiv. What made you go back to the D-League and play there? But was it still that dream?
Well, it was a few things. For one, like I left Khimki and I went and did a mini camp with Milwaukee. And at the time, you know, the Bucks wasn't the Bucks how they are right now. So they posed a little bit of interest before I did the mini camp and went to the mini camp. And apparently they were wowed by me. And I stayed back a while which was weird because I met with the team psychologist and, you know, that was like weird to me because he was asking me what I thought about the city, just random questions. And it was just like, why am I doing this? So they asked me, you know, would I be able to do summer league? And at that time, summer league was starting July 6th. I was getting married on July 6th. And we all know, you know, when the woman plans something and it's already set, it ain't no switching around. So I was like, I don't know if that would be hard to do or whatever, but they said the interest was high. So I tried to work out something where I was like, you know, if I can't do summer league, if your interest is that high, you know, let me come back and work out in the summer to kind of, you know, show that I'm committed to this. And they said, okay, well, we'll speak to your agent. Somehow, when I got to the D-League, they told me my agent botched that deal somehow. But to this day, I guess he won't say how or – it wasn't detailed me to exactly how it got botched, but I still took the D-League offer because my wife was pregnant at the time, too. And I was like, all right, I got a chance. And Sharif Abdul-Rahim called me at the time, and he was working for the Kings. And he was, you know, telling me, like, listen, you know, you're a good player who could play in this league, and I want to feature you in Reno. And, you know, you should give it an opportunity, give it a try. You know, if not, you can always go back to Europe, but you know, you never want to pass up an opportunity. And I was like, you know, you're right. It's good. My wife is pregnant. We can stay in the States. I can try this out and we can see how I go. Right. So it wasn't a more experimental to still kind of having that dream type ordeal, I should say.
Right. But it didn't go over well.
It didn't because
I mean, you played well.
Yeah. It just, the thing is like, it's not always about who's the best in the D-League. You know, sometimes it's more so about needs and what teams want. And that's what I started to understand.
Well, that's the same thing in the NBA, KC. You know that. I mean, you'd be in the right team in the right place at the right time, and you could be the best player there is, and you could be in the wrong team and be a great player and not be able to fit in.
Exactly.
That's anywhere you go there. So what were real quick, though, because what was the travel like, man? That had to be hell, I heard.
Oh, man, it is hell, bro. It is something different, man. I tell you, like, we played a game. I remember we played a game Friday night, and then we got on the bus and took a 9-hour bus ride to Bakersfield to play a game that next night. And it was just like, what in the hell are we doing? Like, it was different. You know, it was completely different. I got much respect for the guys that do it. But the advice that I was giving some of the guys on the team was, you're young, you're coming out of college, try Europe. You know, I was telling them, you know, go to Europe, get you a little bit of money, even if it's just for a year, 2 years. Right. And then, you know, come back and try the G League out or whatever you're going to try, give it a whirl. At least you got some money in your account where you're not banking off a small check because them checks are small. when you get them, it's like they're small.
My boy coached the Charleston Low Gators, man, and I can remember going to see a game one time, and as soon as the game was there, they were jumping on the bus for a 12-hour trip. I don't know where, and I'm like, no, man, that's crazy. That's just crazy. But anyways, you got the hell out of there. That's when you came to Madrid and won it all. That had to be just an amazing year, man. I mean, that was my best.
That was my best year. I say it to this day. You know, it was my best year because my greatest accomplishments. You know, winning everything, winning the EuroLeague title, and a lot of people back home in the States, they don't know, like, the EuroLeague is the second best league under the NBA, you know, second to none. No. Nobody can tell you different. And winning that title puts you in that group.
I always tell people the same thing about the EuroLeague, man. And you know, the NBA is the NBA. But I still think, and it's not because I work for them and I'm doing the podcast, everything else. I always say this, though, no matter where, it's a better product in the long run because every game means so much on a nightly basis.
It does.
I'm not saying it's a better league. People get mad at me when I say it. I'm not saying it's a better league than the NBA because the NBA is the NBA. It's the biggest league in the world. But it's a better product to watch on a nightly basis.
Exactly. Realistically, if you think about it, when you watch an NBA game, especially a regular season game, if it's not a game that pairs two of the marquee teams that's in the NBA right now, It's not much in it for nobody. You know, the stars are the stars, and, you know, every now and then a role player might have a great game. But when you come to Europe, every game counts, points-wise, everything. You're trying to win this game, whether you're the road team or the home team, because, you know, if you're the home team, it's going to be difficult going on the road to steal a game and win by a certain amount of points, especially, you know, if you lose at home. It's difficult. But in the NBA, it's going to the next game if you lose. It's like, okay, we lost by 20.
Right.
We got another game tonight, so let's focus on this game.
And it's very rare you'll see someone go down by 10 or 15 in the EuroLeague and just give up the game.
Oh, no, there's no giving up.
There's not a game they give up. So you win all these titles that year, man. You've done everything with Real Madrid, and I know where you're coming. You and I have such a similar path, like 20 years later, because, you know, I played there for a little bit longer than you did in Real Madrid, and I had the same feeling when I left, man. It's like, man, I didn't want to go. You know, it was just I wanted to finish my career there because the city's incredible, the club is great, the people are wonderful. I mean, that was the same feeling I had. How was it to leave here? That had to kill you.
It did, especially because the way it happened. And I think more so because I was getting in the mindset of finally being somewhere for more than just a year.
Right.
So it was like, finally, I'm somewhere where I know I'm going to be this year and next year. It wasn't a guess of where I was going to be. So I was like, cool, this is where we're going. I'm ecstatic. Let's go.
Especially with a family.
Right.
I mean, if it's just you, that's one thing. But, you know, it affects everybody else around you.
Exactly.
I mean, I could ask you about a million people that you've played with. Not a million in Real Madrid, that's for sure. But you're the one guy that I love. I mean, one of my favorite players on the team back then was Marcus, of course. He was just, you know, he was that ultimate, consummate team player. But what's it like playing with Nocioni, man?
It's great. You love to play with him and you hate to play against him.
That's, yeah, how, exactly.
I explain it to people. You know, like it's one of those ordeals. You love him. I love Chapu, man. You know, he really changed the mentality of the team just the way he played.
He won that Final Four. Not only the Final Four, but he brought character to a team that was missing character over the years before that. That was my opinion.
I think between myself, him, Machulius, Ion, Gustavo, I think we had all brought in something different that was probably that missing link of the team. I feel that way. I mean, others might not think that, but I felt like we were just that missing piece. Even Campazzo, you know, with the little that he did at the time, we all were something different that was needed at that time.
The thing about it, it had nothing, and I'm not saying that y'all aren't talented because you're obviously talented players, but it had nothing to do with talent. It had to do with personality. More
that
than anything
it.
Else. And you guys brought that abstract confidence and that some people were missing in that team, and it changed the whole aspect of what Real Madrid was all about. And it's carried on since then. You know, I mean, I think Nocioni has been...
Yeah, they're still doing good.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I just think he had so much to do with it. But you played Real Madrid, you played the Real Madrid-Barcelona games, you played them in the finals, you've done everything that you needed to do, and then you know what a Barcelona Real Madrid El Clásico is all about. It's pretty damn intense.
Yeah, it is.
You go to Panathinaikos after that. Can you just compare the Greek Derby to the Clásico and just give me?
Man, it is night and day. A Greek Derby compared to El Clásico, it is different. Because the El Clásico has, there's a balance. There's a balance between the court and the stands.
Mm-hmm.
The Greek Derby, there is no balance. There is nothing off limits. I don't care if it's a EuroLeague game. There's going to be something done that's going to draw attention in that game. And it's like the most exciting 40 minutes you can play, you know. And I tell anybody, it seems scary, but it is. It's such a thrill rush. It's a thrill to play in that. And I enjoyed every minute of it.
The thing about it is you've gone there so many times to play games against Panathinaikos, against Olympiakos. I was the same way. I went there to play games. And I'm still, at 54 years old, one of my goals in life is to go watch a Panathinaikos Olympiakos game. I mean, that's one of my goals. It goes, I've been to so many different games in Greece, but I've never seen that game.
I get chills sometimes when I watched the old game the other day from my first year there, and I still get chills watching that game because I felt like I was still in it because that was the rush I got from it.
Let me ask you first about the one you played at Oaxaca. What was that one like? I mean, that's just got to be such a thrill to see that stadium and outside the stadium like just packed like 3-4 hours before the game. It's nuts, man.
Some of the Greek guys would try to tell me like, you know, this is gonna happen. And it's like for me, I knew about peace and friendship simply because, you know, being in Madrid, you know, that's a hated enemy.
Right.
And you know the excitement of how it gets. And they were like, nah, it's worse than that. Like, you're going to see. So we get on the bus and we're driving and I noticed like the streets are kind of clear. Yeah, I could hear the helicopter over the air. And we got the police motorcade on both sides of the bus and escort right in front. And I'm like, this is literally serious. And then you pull up and the fans are standing outside. Jesus, this is that intense. And I'm thinking in my head, it's just a basketball game.
Yeah, but that's a great, it's one of the, I mean, I've never played in that Greek Derby, but playing in either one of those two gyms is the greatest experience I've ever, one of the greatest experiences I've ever had as a player, man.
Oh, it is, awesome.
Man, it seemed like to me, after all this, you were the perfect fit in Panathinaikos, man. You had, I mean, you, number one, you played great against Olympiakos almost every game y'all played again. You had two great seasons there. The place is like a family. I know Madrid is Madrid, and I'm not trying to compare the two because they're two totally different places, but Panathinaikos always had that family atmosphere where, you know, if you're outside the family, like I always want to say the Italian or the Greek family, where if you're outside, you're outside. If you're inside, you're one of us. And you always felt like you were one of them while you were there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, with the fans and everybody, it felt like a place to belong. You know, it was again, another place that I was at that I felt like this is where I could be for a while. And again, you know, different politics, things happen and you're back to square one. But I've always felt like I was a part of it, you know, just simply because of the things I felt like I did against Olympiakos puts me in their eyes in a different light of who I was and where I am in their hearts at that time. So it's like, mm-hmm. for me, I'm always going to feel like I got love there. But at a certain point, like when I went back this year with Zalgiris, it didn't feel like love. You know, it felt like I was like an outcast or outsider at one point. I get it. I was on the opposing team, but it just felt different being there. It wasn't, you know, I was excited to go back because I had been away for about a year and a half from EuroLeague, but just the vibe, the feeling that I got just wasn't, it wasn't the same, you know? It felt different.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get in that whole contract thing. I mean, we talked, I read about it, and it just seemed like it was almost like a mix-up where you felt like you were going to be signed in again, and it didn't work out.
Yeah, and things happen, man, you know, and only those who are involved know what really went on and what happened, and it just stays that way. You know, I have no ill feelings towards anybody. I never do, you know, because I look at it like life has a way of working itself out, and you're supposed to be and supposed to do things that are meant for you to do. So I can't really be mad at anybody.
You had explained to the listeners here in the crossover that while you were there, you had an autoimmune deficiency.
So it wasn't it wasn't autoimmune. Like that is what they attributed it to, but it definitely wasn't, because when I came home, I told I started working out with a new trainer in California, and they had a facility there. I spoke to the doctor there and told him what was going on, and he looked at me, and literally, I kid you not, man, he looked at me and started dying laughing. Like he laughed. Laughed so hard. He said, "Who told you this?" And I said, "This is what they were telling me when I was over there." I mean, he's like, "Listen, if you know what autoimmune is, you would not be able to train like you're training right now with an autoimmune deficiency." He said, "It attacks the body." He said, "It constantly attacks the body. It's right. Nonstop. It's not something that just comes and goes away." So then I explained to him what was going on, and he looked at my shoulder and everything. And he's like, "For you," he said, "you have narrow bone gaps. So some of these nerves and stuff, they don't necessarily get the freedom to flow through these gaps like other people." And he said, "Somehow," he said, "this area just got worked and that nerve got trapped in that arm, causing it to lose its strength." And he asked me, he said, "How long did it take you to recover?" I said, "Well, after finding out what it was and doing a couple of therapies and strength exercises, it took about a week and a half, 2 weeks to regain full strength to where I actually, you know, could feel it and know that I had a strength in it." He's like, "Exactly." Right. He's like, "You work this nerve out of this entrapment." He said, "It might have taken some time," but he's like, "You don't have autoimmune deficiency." He said, "We can test your blood and everything for you if you want to go that route, but you don't have it." So I took that as great news. And then I seen another guy who's a sports doctor, and his son was training with my trainer. And I asked him just to have another opinion, you know, to make sure, you know, because you hear one thing from one person, you always want to make sure that it's kind of on the same lines. And he was basically saying the same thing. Right. He's like, "You wouldn't be able to train as hard as you're training right now if you had that." He's like, I've seen this injury countless times with volleyball players and other players. He's like, "It's just a thing of nerve entrapments, and it happened, unfortunately, at the wrong time," you know?
Right. You took my next question away then, because my next question was, man, I've never heard of anybody with an autoimmune deficiency that actually worked through it. You know what I mean? That's something that stays in your body. So that was going to be my next question. So we'll move on from that. But like you said, you know, timing's timing, man. And things happen in life, as you know, you've said throughout this interview that things happen for reasons, and you put yourself in different positions. But you're kind of like just one of these easygoing guys. I've read some of your articles, your interviews. Yeah, you kind of that same attitude that I've always had. It's like, look, you make decisions or things happen in life, and through those decisions and through those circumstances, it's up to you not to make it the wrong decision. It's up to you to make it the right decision.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, people do something, they say, "Well, I made the wrong decision," and they just kind of give up and quit, and they don't make it work. But the alternative is to say, "You know what? Maybe this was the wrong decision, but I'm going to make the best out of it for the rest of this time." It seems like that's your personality and your attitude. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I've got from this interview. But where do you get that from? Where do you get that perseverance from mentally to get through anything any hardship or anything that didn't go your way?
I think it just comes from just going through a lot of heartaches and stuff growing up, kind of coach myself through it, and just, you know, this is how life worked, you know. And then my wife is always constantly in my ear, you know, letting me know, like, sometimes you can't control the things that are happening, like, they're out of your control. Stop trying to control them. And I've always had a habit of that, always feeling like, I wish I would have been able to control something. It's like, you can't do it. And she always reminds me, like, you can't control what happens or what others think of you or what, you know, somebody's decision is going to be. It's impossible. That's out of your control. If they don't like you, they don't like you. You can't control that.
You sure she's not telling you can't control me?
No, not at all. But see, I mean, we've had these conversations before where, you know, Courtney will say it. She'll say it to me every time. Like, listen, like, you can't control that. Like, that's out of your control. Like, you can only do what you're capable of doing. And, you know, the rest is up to them to decide. If they like you, they'll find a way to keep you. If not, then, you know, just peace out and see them next time. Put them on your list.
Exactly, man. Exactly. I mean, that's just the way it has to be, because when something's not in your control, there's not much you can do about it except for go crazy trying to take over that feeling. But, you know, I checked you out beforehand, as I do all my research. I checked you out on social media. I saw a lot of pictures. You're not very active social media, but I did see you a lot with your kids, with your young kids. They're 6 and 3, as we mentioned before. And you're doing this interview from home. It's you just sound like the family man, because we could hear them running around in the back and playing. It's just it's an awesome feeling to have that connection.
I just told him, like, listen, daddy's doing an interview. You know, you got to be quiet, or, you know, go into the family room. And every time they come in here, daddy, what you doing? Like, it's like, I just told you I'm doing an interview. Like,
you just look over and say, hey, man, some old guy in Spain's got me on the line for way too long. I'm about to get off. Don't worry. I'll hang up on him in a minute. Let me go back to the social media thing, man, because you're not big into social media. And I just feel like, when I played, man, I never really worried about what people thought of me or said about me, no matter how good or how bad I played. You know, I took the positive and I just took it as the same way I took the negative. But nowadays, man, I can't imagine. You know, my day, you just didn't watch the TV, you didn't turn the TV on, you didn't go buy the paper. Nowadays, the comments come straight at you. How hard is that as a player?
It's difficult because people, you know, behind computers and these phones, they're tough guys, I say. And it's not to threaten or say, you know, I'm this tough guy, it doesn't matter. But everybody feels comfortable saying what they want to say behind, you know, a screen or anything. But until they see you in person, most of the time, the people that see you in person that talk shit behind the screen are
never
some of your fans, you know, they're the ones asking for autographs and everything. And it's,
of course,
it's a head scratcher. It's like hard to understand, like, why I do this? I had a guy the other day, actually, I posted a video of my kids jumping in the pool and everything, and this guy sends a message, and I don't usually look at my request messages. Every time I look here and there, and I just so happened to click on it, seen his message, and he said, hey, you owe me 30 euros. And I'm reading it, and he goes on to say, you missed the shot to win the game against Zenit, and, you know, your team lost in the overtime, and I betted that you guys were going to win, so you owe me 30 euros. This is your fault. Like, help me out here. And I'm thinking, like, first and foremost, I didn't tell you to place that bet. Nobody told you. You should bet at your own risk. Like, I'm not about to give you 30 euros because you think I got it and it's beneficial for you. Like, who does that? I mean, I've gotten messages from Red Star was the worst because it went too far. You know, it goes too far. There's a line for me that never should be crossed. Like, you can say whatever you want to me. I'm sure people hate me. Some people love me. You know, at this point now, I've grown to understand that and not really care and embrace it. But when you start to bring in the families into it, and first and foremost, dude, it's a game. At the end of the day, it's a game. It's just a game to me. Whether you look at it like it's a life and death thing for you, like, to me, it's another game. You know, at the end of the day, I'm going to feel bad if we lost. Like, I'm going to analyze the loss. But I don't need you sitting here threatening my family and threatening harm because we lost. Like, that's not how I operate. You know, that's where the line is drawn at for me.
You know, the more dedicated fans are, the more dangerous they are sometimes too. And that's, but the 30 euro thing makes me think about a story I just heard like last year about, oh, the one with, it was with Phil Mickelson when he had that match with Tiger Woods.
Uh-huh.
And some guy walked up to him. You know, Phil's like really well known for carrying around wads of money and like it's just cash. I mean, he's strictly cash. And I guess some guy came up and was pretty drunk and said, hey, man, he's like, you know, you lost that match to Tiger. You lost that match. He's like, man, I bet $100. I lost $100. He's like, you owe me $100. Same exact thing. They said Phil reached into his pocket and pulled out $9,100 bills because that's what he won that day.
Uh-huh.
And he said, here, take one. And that reminds me of that some guy telling you that you owe 30 because he bet on your team.
That's crazy, like, it's like, I don't tell you to do, like, who told you to bet? Like, I wanted to write back and be like, man, like, that's at your own risk. Don't involve.
Yeah, don't even bother that.
But, you know, like you said, we're the same, but we're different because in one breath, like, you don't listen to people and pay attention to negativity. You just focus on the positive. Me, for a long time, man, I used to read comments. People berating me and stuff. And, you know, for me, at first it hurt, but then it was like, I want to show you. Like, this is why I'm here. I want
to
show you.
Well, you can motivate, too. Yeah, it does. It can motivate you, too.
It can hurt you, too. And it hurt me at times. Yeah. I think, like, these are my fans. These are the people I play for. And, yeah, it hurts me that we lost, but stick behind me. You know, why berate me in such a way where it's like, damn, like, then it makes me feel like I got to be a bad guy because then I don't want to sign autographs and I don't want to, you know, take pictures and all that because I look at it like, these could be the same people that's talking shit to you on the internet.
Exactly.
You're sitting there chumming it up with them.
Hey, speaking of Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods, I did see on your IG too, man. You got a nice little golf swing, man. I could work on you a little bit, but you still playing?
Yeah, when I can. I mean, it sucks right now that these courses here are closed. I wish I could get out there. My father-in-law is an avid golfer, so I took golf up simply because, you know, he's short. He ain't playing no basketball, but it's fun to get out there. He talks his junk, and, you know, he plays on a regular, so I just like to be out there. It's nice. It's quiet. You can be whatever. You can be good. You can be bad. You know, golf is just unpredictable. One day you can be great, hitting it nice straight down the fairway, and the next day you can come back and you're hitting it in the trees everywhere. Can't find your ball. So
yeah, have you gotten out with your coach with Yesikevicius? Saris is a big golfer.
No, I haven't, because you know when it's time to focus with Saris, it ain't no. ain't no outside distractions.
I couldn't imagine.
I'm sure the competitive side of him will come out if
exactly.
We were to ever play golf.
That's what I was going to say. I couldn't even imagine going out and playing 18 holes with him, man. He would drive you crazy. He'd be in your ear the whole time.
He's competitive. That's for sure.
You got a handicap yet? I saw that swing, man. I think it was back in 2016.
Yeah, I was supposed to do it when I was with Madrid. We used to have Mondays off. And the Bank of Santander has a private course in Madrid. They have a private place. So I was going there taking lessons and stuff. And I was supposed to go on a nine-hole handicap with the guy, but I didn't end up doing it because I ended up leaving. So I actually need to get one. I'm sure my handicap's going to be pretty it ain't going to be great, right? But
back in my day, I got myself down under 8, man. That was before I got divorced. So it was, you know, it was like I was out playing every day, man. Every chance I got down under an 8. And I just loved the game, but then I just stopped playing. It's hard on the body after a while, man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you got to adjust your clubs to a certain height, length, and the back sometimes it takes a toll on the back every now and then. But I enjoy it when I do play. To me, it's just relaxing, you know.
What do you think, let's finish this up in a more of the personal stuff here. What's the hardest time you've had as an athlete in your life? I mean, you've talked about the fact that you haven't had very, very many difficult times, but you've had a bunch of times that have tested you. Injuries, obstacles. What was the hardest moment you've had?
I think a year and a half ago when I wasn't getting a job to go anywhere, that was hard because then I started really questioning who I was as a player, as a person. Like, I literally was in this mindset that it was just over. I was kind of depressed because I was like, nobody wants me as a player now. I was like, what happened that drove everybody away? And I wake up every day. And I mean, if you ask David Carl, he would tell you, I'm hitting him up every day. What's happening, man? And he's like, listen, everybody's curious, but everybody's worried about this autoimmune or this and that. And I'm like, but I didn't have that. You know, I'm like, I don't have it. I'm working out. I'm doing videos. We showed one video of me doing a workout. I was doing a conditioning part of the workout, and I'm knocking down shot after shot. And he tells me, the club tells him, it doesn't look like he's going full speed. And it's like, dude, I'm doing a conditioning drill. I'm shooting knees while I'm tired. Like, I'm dead tired. I'm gassed.
Right.
I even cut body weight. Like, I lost literally a lot of weight just because I literally changed my diet. I did everything trying to figure out what is it that's not attracting teams to say, okay, we want KC back in, or what's going on with KC? Nobody. So I literally was at a point where I literally was seeing black, man. And I'm not even lying. I was to a depressed stage that it was like, if I got any deeper, it wasn't no coming back from that.
You know, not too many people are capable of estimating the amount of confidence a professional athlete can have and how quickly it can be crumbled by something like that. You know, no matter how confident you are, the moment that someone doesn't want you or they're not calling you, man, it really gets to you, no matter who you are, no matter what you've been through. It's not an easy time. When you show up the preseason, for example, and you check out the EuroLeague schedule, my first question is a two-part question. My first question is, when you look at that schedule, you're like, yeah, I can't wait to go play that team. What's that one team that you have that you always seem to play well against?
It's always Olympiacos for me now. Like, always, anytime I see Olympiacos, even Madrid for that matter, like, I've always got them circled. And it's
always played good against them.
Yeah, and it's nothing, no hate towards them or anything, but just for Madrid, it's just like, it's always like I felt like I still had to prove, like, I still belong there in a sense. End of the day, the days have passed. It is what it is, but it's just to show, like, this is where I thought I was going to be, and I could still play and whatnot. And it's just like a personal jab for myself. Nothing, you know, against anybody in the organization, right? Because at the end of the day, they were great.
No. I get it. My second one is, because now you can go back the other way. Now, my second one is, what's the one that you look at that player, that team, where you're like, oh man, I am not looking forward to playing against them, man. I can't stand playing against him. The guy that defends you the best, the guy that just, because my guy would have been, I would have hated, like you said earlier, I would have hated to play against Nocioni. I would have looked at that schedule and been dreading, you know, if we had to play him on January 21st, the whole month of January, I would have been like, oh shit, here he comes.
I think it would just be like playing against like Kempke at the moment, because you know, with Chavette, I've every time we play Kempke, I've always ended up guarding Chavette. So it's right. It's the thought of he's going to take multiple shots, and if he's on that day, it's just like, you look at your coach and he's putting his hands up and it's like, what you want me to do, man? It's like, I'm in front of him, I'm mm-hmm. putting my hands up, I can't foul him, he's going to get to the line, he has that much respect. And it's not the thought of I got to deal with this guy, but it's more so because it's like anything he does, like, you know, he's shooting it from a certain point, and right. you're there. And if he makes it, it's like, I was there. What do you want me to do? He was 30 feet away from the basket, and he made it. I'm sorry. I was, you know, that's like one player that I would say it for me, because I've guarded him. You know, it's like, oh, right. Here we go. You know, you expect the deep shots, and you expect, you know, miraculous thing, him getting to the free throw line. You can't breathe on him too much, or you're going to get a foul call. So it's like,
right. See, I didn't care about anybody dropping 30 on me, but I just care about Nocioni throwing those elbows at me and beat me up throughout the game. That would have bothered me about him.
But see, you know, the thing about that is he did it a couple times in practice, but he would, at the end of practice, he would tell you, like, it's nothing personal, but this is right. sometimes how the game's got to be played, and he's preparing us for it. And it's like,
yeah.
You got it. He goes 110%. He goes hard, man. Like, when I say, like,
it's crazy.
In practice, you're thinking in your head, okay, we play in a day or so. He probably going to be chill. And then he's playing on the wing at this point. He's like, oh, Jesus, he's about to go in for a rebound. And you're down there fighting with him. It's like, oh, my God.
Hey, man, you're 33 years old, man. You just, you know, you got the season cut short, unfortunately. Kaunas is a nice place. It's a EuroLeague team. How long do you want to play this game, and what are your plans when it's all done and over with? Now, I hear you said earlier you're studying some day trading and stuff like that, but what are your plans when this is all done and over with, man? That's a huge question for me, because when I think about the fact that I played this game for like 12, 13 years professionally, but I've been retired for 20, it's a long time to go when this is all done and said, and it's all over.
It is. I mean, for me, I look at it like I want to probably get into broadcasting, something similar to what you're doing, you know.
Man, don't come and take my job now. No, come on. I got enough people trying to do that.
But I hear people always tell me that I analyze the game real well. I feel like that is something I would probably dabble in. Coaching, maybe. I don't know, man. These kids today, they different than when I came up. So coaching, it's got to be a certain level that I would probably do. But, I mean, right now, yeah, I'm just literally like, I'm like kind of dabbling into everything right now. I'm jumping on real estate. I'm looking at real estate investments and stuff to try to do, and a lot of like trading stocks and Forex trading, just something that's different that can occupy my time. But it's a question to really be thoughtful. I mean, I think as far as playing, I had a conversation with Milan Tomic when I first got the Red Star, and he asked me that question. And he told me how long he right. played for. And he's like, listen, if you can still shoot and move, man. He's like, I say ride it till the wheels fall off. And I was like, you know.
Absolutely.
It's funny, because I was like, if I could do that, yeah, for sure. Like, it wouldn't be a problem. It's just how much am I willing to continue to do, you know, the travel and everything. I think that's what really takes a toll. I don't think it's the sport itself, the game itself. I think it's the travel and everything else behind it. The preparation is what's going to come from it.
If I have to finish this with a bit of advice, I can tell you that it's been 20 years since I retired. I probably could have played 2-3 more years after I retired. And to this day, 20 years later, it's still a decision I kind of regret. So yeah, do it until you know it's over.
Oh, yeah,
you know
sure.
What I mean? Don't do it because you think it's over. But hey, man, I got to, first and foremost, do me a favor, take care of yourself and your family. Second of all, I want to thank you for catching up with me and allowing me this time to hear your story, man, and share it with my listeners. Good luck to you from here at the Crossover, man. We just want to wish you, me personally, because we've been kind of boys for a little bit. I just want to wish you the best of luck and take care of you and your family, man. Thanks a lot so much for taking this time out with me, and especially 9 hours difference. You'll be waking up with the kids around. Loved having you as a guest, Casey.
Hey, thanks, Joe, man. You and your family be safe as well, man. I appreciate you for having me on.
Same thing, man. We'll talk soon.
Thanks for listening to The Crossover with Joe R. Lucas. If you like what you've heard, subscribe now so you don't miss an episode, and leave us a review on iTunes and Apple Podcasts. You can also get in touch via Twitter and Instagram at EuroLeague using the hashtag ELCrossover or on Facebook at the EuroLeague.